Welcome to another episode of Daughters of Mormonism. I'm your host, Sybil. Today we're having a panel discussion about sex education. On our panel today, we've got Sarah.
Hi.
Julianne.
Hello.
And Heather.
Hello.
Hi. All right. I'm so glad that we're all here and that we have this fascinating topic to discuss. All right. So first of all, what kind of sex education did we receive from our parents?
I don't think that my, well, I know that my parents never talked to me about the act of sex or any kind of sex at all. My mom had a talk with me, you know, kind of before I was going to be going into puberty, and that was very helpful. She did a great job with that. But I never, anything that I learned about sex, I learned from school, my friends, church, books, like not one word of it came from my parents.
So you pretty much got nothing from your parents then?
Not a thing.
Wow.
My mom was the only one that I was able to talk to, but I remember that she bought a book for my brother and I when we were still in elementary school, and it was, you know, just a Where the Babies Come From kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that she'd whited out certain parts, and I was, I guess, old enough or curious enough to ask her what the parts were that she whited out, because I wanted to know the whole story, of course. And she told me that she had whited out all the parts that referenced God.
Oh.
So that is the only thing that I remember, you know, as my of my mom actually sitting us down and telling us about that or reading that book to us. And I guess maybe back in the day when I was little, the only books that were available were books that had some kind of religious aspect to it. I don't know if the only one that she could get her hands on that was available. But I didn't grow up in the church, and we didn't actively participate in any church or anything. So I guess she wanted to have that completely free of any reference to God, which I remember for me at that age, even I thought that was weird, because I thought everything that was written in that book was true. And so for me, it was strange that she would white out, you know, part of the story. And I thought, well, if God has something to do with Where the Babies Come From, why would she not want me to know that part? So that's the only thing that I distinctly remember about any information I got about sex or how, you know, babies come into being and anything like that. And then from then on, I know that when I had a question about certain, you know, words, slang words that my older friends had used, I would come to my mom and she would explain it to me. And she, I think she did a pretty good job, but she did send me some mixed messages about body image and things like that.
That's interesting, Julianne. My parents also gave me sort of a Where Do Babies Come From approach to sex education in our home. My mom had this series of books that were about the nature of babies developing in the womb and growing up and things like that. And once they were born and infants and so forth. And they had these really detailed drawings where you could like see all the little veins on the fetus and stuff like that. And it showed, you know, how the fetus progressed and grew. And so she would sit us all down, and I had quite a few brothers and sisters. So she'd sit us all down on the couch, and my dad would sit there and be supportive and silent. I don't remember him ever saying a single word during these sessions. And my mom had a lot of kids. So every time that she was about to have another baby, she would get out these books and she would show us how the baby was growing inside of her, and that this was really wonderful, and that this was part of God's plan. So she definitely didn't have that part whited out. And inevitably, one of us would ask, well, but how does the baby get inside? Because we could all see her womb swelling more and more. And she'd say, well, the dad has the sperm and the mom has the egg. And when the sperm and the egg get together, then they start to make a baby. And then, of course, you know, the older and more curious we got, well, how does the sperm get to the egg? And I finally remember at only once her finally kind of sort of very awkwardly and strangely trying to describe the act of intercourse and how freaked out we all were. It sounded scary, and I don't know, like it, we were all just kind of freaked. And so, and she tried to say, well, but no, this is part of God's plan. And I don't remember which one of us asked, but we were kind of like, and you like it? And And it was interesting because I got kind of a mixed message. I kind of got the message of, I don't know if like is necessarily so much a part of it, but this is how it's supposed to go. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first kind of hint that maybe it wasn't such a great idea. I don't know. So it was an interesting message. And then it wasn't until I was about to be married that my mom gave me one other talk where she basically, the essence of it was, please don't be alarmed by your husband's anatomy. And mm-hmm. that was about it. That was the sex education that I got at home. How about you, Heather?
I first learned about sex when I was in second grade, and the little girl across the street asked me if I knew what sex was, and I said no. And she said, it's when a boy pees in a girl's pee hole. And this time, this image of that's what sex was, and I wasn't going to ask my parents because you don't talk about the stuff down there. I had recurrent UTIs as a child, and so repeatedly into my brain was, don't touch yourself down there. Don't touch yourself down there, because of the health impact for me. So I just knew that anything down there was dirty. And so I didn't ask my parents about that at all. In fifth grade, when we had the like puberty talk at school, at one point we went to like a museum about the human body. They had stuff about the heart and the brain and stuff. And they had like, you know, also like a hallway that had like pictures of fetal development. Mm-hmm. And they had like a little movie, and it talked about like the guy's side with the sperm and the girl's side with the egg, and it didn't put them together. But like, I was like 11 and I could put those two together. So when my parents finally got around to having the sex talk when I was in sixth grade, probably right before going into young women's, my dad wasn't involved. It's just my mom. And she like, we went down to the basement and had the sex talk. And I was like, mom, I figured it out. And she was like, oh, well, maybe we should have done this sooner. And I was like, yeah, maybe. But like, it still wasn't very explicit. Like her sex talk, it kind of consisted of a blank sheet of white paper, you know, 8.5 by 11, that represented the vulva area. And like over here, she would point to, this is where your urethra is, and here's where your butt is, and in the middle of there is your vagina, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's like it. There was no actual diagrams. I had no clue like what the distance or size or anything of that.
It was just a blank piece of paper?
Completely blank.
Oh my goodness. That's a startling metaphor for something.
Yeah. And that was the end of that. And even as a teenager, like 14 or 15, talking to my cousin one day, and I turned to her and I was like, how do you know that they're not peeing in you? Like, I had no clue how you'd be able to tell the difference between sperm and pee, because the whole like erection part had never been explained to me. When I was about 16 or so, my mom had a second sex talk with me, and that was, oh, Heather, years ago when we had the sex talk with you, we didn't mention masturbation or oral sex. Don't do those. And if what you're imagining is really gross, that's what oral sex is. And that was the end of that conversation. I mean, like, I'm not dumb. I knew what oral meant. Like, we gave oral presentations at school. Use your mouth, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to figure that out. Yeah, that was my sex ed until like college and stuff.
Wow. So what about our sex education that we received from the church? Because that's the other really dominant way, especially for Mormons, that we receive a lot of our sex education outside of school and friends and things like that.
I don't actually remember much about sex education at all, except that we're supposed to be chaste. And someone explained, I don't know when that was explained, what chastity meant. And I don't remember the bishop asking that when I was 12. Like, I think our bishop was smart enough not to, I don't know. He just didn't ask the 12-year-old girls about that, which is probably a good thing. But the stuff that I had available to me in my parents' home was like the Family Home Evening Resource Manual. That's where I learned what masturbation was. I was looking through it one day, and there's a section on talking to your children about chastity and procreation. And I read that section, and I was, I don't know, probably early teens, like 12 or 13. And that's when I came across the word masturbation. And it only talks about, at that point, directing it towards boys. And so I didn't think it was something I needed to worry about as a girl. And then I didn't get any sort of other sex education through church until like college, because I went to BYU and I took like the basic health class. And they had actually a pretty thorough, I took it online, they had an online option. And it was actually a very, very thorough sex education, I thought, in that it explained about lubrication and those sorts of things that you don't get typically in this, you know, mm-hmm. sex ed with your parents. I thought that was pretty good.
I think most of the sex education I got from the church involved saying basically sex is off limits. Don't let anybody touch you. I don't think I was ever told not to touch myself because I was a girl and I was quiet. So that wasn't really, mm-hmm. I think it was mostly don't let the boys touch you and don't let the boys look at you and dress modestly. Like sex education seemed to have a lot more to do with, like Heather was saying, being chaste and modest and keeping certain parts of your body off limits.
Yeah. In a way, it was like the law of chastity for boys was don't have sex, and the law of chastity for girls was don't let the boys think that you want to have sex, but it was still about the boys. One thing that I have learned more getting older is just that, like, my experience growing up Mormon is not necessarily everyone's experience. So I can't say how widespread this was, but the main message that I got as a young woman in the church was actually kind of this very scary, eventually very damaging view of boys and men, that they were like sex crazed maniacs. And like, if they saw the small of your back, or if they saw a hint of cleavage, or if you wore shorts that were too short, they were going to be thinking about sex nonstop, and you better not become pornography for them. Like, it was just this weird thing where we set up this idea that boys just were in this terrible situation with their sexual drives, but that we as women, or girls at that point, like, we didn't have to, we didn't pay attention to our own sex drives, or at least our lesson plans didn't, you know. It wasn't ever like, when you want to have sex, remember this. It was, boys are going to want to have sex, so you need to be prepared for that. And it was this weird power trip, I think, of, wow, I have a lot of power over what boys do and what boys think. And I was told that explicitly in those exact words all the time, that I had the most power in dating relationships. And if things went wrong, it was more my responsibility than the boys. And it was just, but it was a power trip, but it was also kind of intimidating, because if boys are really like this and I'm going to marry a boy someday, like, what is that going to be? It got really discouraging for me, I think, the way that sex ed was handled. In a certain way, I felt like boys need to respect me and respect my body, and I expected that and demanded that, so that was good. But at the same time, I didn't have a lot of faith in sexuality being a good thing at all. So I think that was really sad, honestly. Well, it's been really sad for me trying to come to terms with that now that I'm married. But that was kind of the approach that a lot of my young women leaders and my bishops took.
I didn't grow up in the church, but I feel very strongly, like you, Sarah, that the sex education that comes from the church is kind of separated into what we teach the boys and what we teach the girls. Mm-hmm. So I didn't actually get any of those chastity talks in young women or anything like that, because I was already with the young single adults pretty much when I joined the church. And so I was dating and then later was engaged. And so all the sex that I got was a couple talks that we had with our bishop before we got married, who was talking to us about chastity. And then, you know, just some lessons in Relief Society about, or sacrament meeting talks about the, you know, general laws of chastity and how sex is holy and things like that. But the overall atmosphere in the church seems to be that the sexual identity of women is completely ignored, and the sexual identity of men is very much denigrated into something, you know, animalistic, and like they can't control themselves, and
yeah,
they're the only ones with those base, dirty, filthy passions, and the women are the saintly, angelic virgins that need to protect their virtue, not only their own virtue, but in the words of Sister Dalton, is it Dalton?
Yeah, the young women president.
Who says that, you know, the young women are the guardians of virtue, not just their own virtue, but the boys also. And I just think that it's a very damaging view, a very damaging way to teach about sex, is to, one, completely ignore the needs and desires of one gender, and to completely magnify in a bad way the ones of the other gender. Yeah. I don't know how to say it better, but it just seems like we're on the opposing ends of a spectrum, when really I don't believe that's how it is.
Right.
And that's maybe just because I haven't grown up in the church, but I always have felt that I was a very sexual person just as much as any other girl or guy I've ever met. I've had sexual desires. And then when I joined the church, I felt like I was expected to become this asexual person who wasn't interested in sex at all. And that I was to almost fear men for their yeah. ideas of sex or their sex drives or how they would look at me or things like that.
Yeah.
So as you were talking, Julianne, I suddenly remembered this chastity talk that I got while I was in college. And the bishop was talking to all of the students. So it was the males and females. We were all in this big old room. And he had drawn this line on the board, and it was marked off into sections. So, and the first mark said holding hands, and the next one said kiss on the cheek or something, you know, and then the next one a lip kiss. And anyway, it just kind of went on and on, and it had necking and petting, and then it had all the way, I think, was the last one.
Yeah.
And then this is what he did. He asked a young woman to come up. And he said, do you like boys? And she said, yeah, sure. And he said, okay, so let's suppose there's this guy you really like. And she said, okay. And he said, all right, so we're going to start right here. So I want you to tell me where you would stop. Okay. And she said, all right. And he said, okay, ready? And she said, okay. And then he just zoomed the chalk, drawing underneath the entire line to all the way. And he said, you didn't tell me to stop.
That's horrible.
And she was, yeah. And she was like, but. And what he was teaching so dramatically right then was, it's your job. And if you don't say stop soon enough, he's going to push you all the way before you even know what has happened.
Right.
And that was terrifying, not to mention unjust.
And ridiculous, I think, too, because how frustrating is it to feel like you can't physically express your love for somebody when you're dating them, even by holding hands or kissing them? You know, we kind of get this message that it's like this slippery slope. And if you're sitting on this sled at a top of a hill, and if you start going down that hill, beware, like things are just going to get out of hand. And so you do start to set up these restrictions for yourself about how you're not going to cross whatever line. And the line probably depends on what your bishop or your parents or your young women or young men leaders told you the line should be. You're just going to set up this line that says anything beyond this is not love, when kissing can be a way to show somebody that you love them. And it's a wonderful thing. And I think it's terrible that we just write that off as like a lustful temptation in the church across the board. Ugh. Yeah. I hate that analogy. And I've heard that exact chalkboard thing that you're talking about a lot, Sybil. Yeah. It's so frustrating.
Too. And also the whole thing about the slippery slope thing that you were just talking about, Sarah, I think it's very overused in the church. It makes people draw arrows between things that don't really have any relation to each other.
Right.
Like, because I hold somebody's hand doesn't mean that I'm going to have sex with them. I just think that, you know, to make such an extreme statement and to teach things in that way, it just reinforces that young people don't have any control over their bodies or their sexual drive. So they're not to be trusted. And mm-hmm. so they can't express those feelings at all, ever, unless right. they're married. And I think it actually disempowers young people because it makes them feel that their bodies are this out of control thing that they have no power over. And I think that those kind of object lessons or teachings, it actually is counterproductive to what the church is trying to teach, which is that we are supposed to be in control over our bodies. But yeah. at the same time, they're telling us that we're not. And so I feel that this mixed message is really detrimental when it comes to sex education.
Yeah.
So what should be discussed in sex education? What do we wish was part of our education sexually?
I really, one of my little pet project, or not, what, it's the opposite of a pet peeve. Does that exist? My favorite little thing that parents can do, especially in sex education, is to use the appropriate names for parts of the body. And I actually want to read something. It comes from the Gospel Principles Manual. I know that something similar to this is printed in the New Gospel Principles Manual, but this exact text comes from the 1978 version. It says in here, parents can begin teaching children to have proper attitudes toward their bodies when children are very young. Talking to children frankly but reverently and using the correct names for the parts and functions of their bodies will help them grow up without unnecessary embarrassment about their bodies. And I think that's really empowering. In my family, I have four little brothers and I'm the only girl. And we called our brothers' penises inks. Like that was our slang for a penis, I guess, was the word ink. But we never had a slang word or a real word for a vagina or a vulva or anything like that. It was like it wasn't even there. And I think it would be really marvelous if part of sex education that Mormon families really felt okay about was to say words like penis and scrotum and erection and words like vulva and vagina and labia, and to really use them and not, and have it just be like teaching your kid what their ears are called or what their fingernails are called. It's just a part of their body that is good, like all the other parts.
So Sarah, did they just not even have a word for your genitals?
I never learned anything like that until I was in seventh grade. And I don't even remember being curious about it, to be honest. I don't remember ever going to my parents and saying, what's this called or anything like that. We didn't talk about the girls' parts at all. And maybe part of it was because I was the oldest and I was the only girl. So it's not like I had any little sisters that we could be talking about. They would only be talking about me if they were to bring up those words. And maybe that felt uncomfortable.
Crazy to me. I can't believe that you went to seventh grade and didn't know what your genitals were called. And that's, you know, it was a few weeks ago, I went to a parent-teacher conference for my twins who are going to be going to kindergarten this fall. And as I was talking to the teacher, one of them was playing on a chair and fell off. And she started screaming, "Mom, I hurt my vagina." And I've had the experience talking to friends at church that they're uncomfortable naming their children's genitals with the correct terms, but I feel that has something to do with them not being comfortable naming their own genitals or talking about their own genitals. Mm-hmm. That probably, you know, if I step out of the shower and my kids come in and they ask me, you know, what's this, I tell them, well, those are my breasts, those, that's my vagina, that's my bottom, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's, obviously they don't ask me anymore because they've seen me like a million times now. But I was always open with them with what those parts are called and what they look like on a grown woman and what their parts are called and what they look like on a little girl. And I want them to know what a normal woman looks like, not one that you can see airbrushed in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm fairly confident, you know, with my sexual identity and with the way my body looks. And so I can talk to my kids about that relatively confidently. And I think that's why they're so confident about their own bodies and talking about their genitals like it's just another body part, which it is. But it definitely gets me some raised eyebrows when I talk to people in the church who come up with names such as, you know, down there or wee wee or hoo ha or hoo hoo or whatever, weird, silly names like that.
Well, Sarah, if it's any consolation, my three-year-old knows where her vulva is. The other day we were all taking a big family shower together and she said, "Mommy, you have a vulva like me and Daddy has a penis like Isaac," her little 11-month-old brother. And then she said, "And Daddy and Mommy have hair and I'll have hair." And well, I told her, you know, "You'll get hair someday." And she's like, "Yes, when I'm five." In her three-year-old mind, everything is when I'm five. So yeah, she likes her vulva. She actually will say that. "I like my vulva." One thing that I've noticed, like with teaching her body parts, like when you said, you know, teach it just like an ear, this was something early on when we were teaching her, you know, where's your ear, where's your elbow? And at one point I was like, I thought to myself, should I ask her, you know, where's your vulva? And I was like, if I don't ask it, is that me being weird about it? But if I do ask it, are people going to think that I'm like some creepy person who asks, you know, their child to point to their vulva? Right. And I went ahead and like asked her, you know, where's your vulva? And she found it, you know.
Yeah.
But because I didn't want her to think that, like, I was going to treat her vulva as something weird and separate that I don't talk about. I don't know. I didn't know exactly how to approach that. And that might be just me and my own issues, obviously.
Right. No, I think that's a part of being a courageous parent. And I completely admire you both, Julianne and Heather, for saying, to heck with the raised eyebrows, I'm going to teach my kids what is true. Because that gets into my testimony, I think, a lot of what parenting is. And that comes from the church. The church is what taught me that I need to be dedicated to being a good parent one day. And I think teaching your kids that their sexual parts and their sexual identities are important and good is very courageous, and it totally, totally a part of being a good parent.
So I know for me as a girl growing up, I felt like I didn't ever really get any understanding of what was supposed to be going on down there is kind of, you know, the euphemism that gets thrown around a lot. And I think it, like, I remember as a very, very painfully shy, awkward young teen, you know, maybe 14 or something, being in the doctor's office for just a checkup or whatever, and him saying, do you ever have vaginal discharge? And I just wanted to drop through the floor. I didn't even ever want to come out again. I wanted to die right then, because I didn't know whether I was supposed to say yes or whether I was supposed to say no. And he was a male, and my mom was looking at me expectantly. And I mean, it was terrifying. It was this horrible, horrible experience for me. And it wasn't until I was in college, I remember going to the library and searching out books that basically, you know, 100 questions you would want to ask your gynecologist, but don't dare, or whatever, you know, books like that. Anyway, and I stacked up a ton of books on the table. And one of them was called Woman and Intimate Geography by Natalie Angier. It's a marvelous book. Anyway, so I started looking through those different books until I finally found the answer to what I was looking for. And it was in Angier's book that I found the answer that I wanted, that was empowering me to understand why my body was doing this and that it was awesome that it was doing it. Like, I remember it talking about the vagina like it was the finest culture ever, that it rivaled any yogurt, no matter how gourmet, that it was finer than wine, like that the ecology that it was able to sustain, and how the particular pH of it was balanced just so that it would both hamper sperm and also allow them to go through with the different mucuses and so forth that it had. Anyway, it was brilliant and fascinating. And I thought, why didn't anyone ever tell this to me when I was young and terrified, so that I could have looked that doctor in the face and said, mind your manners. This is my body, and I've already learned about it, and I don't need to answer your questions, or answered his questions and felt no shame. I can't even imagine either of those scenarios in my mind as an awkward young teen.
So I was a teenager at some point, and I remember wiping after going to the bathroom and finding, you know, mucus discharge, and I didn't know what it was. So I went to my mom and asked her, hey, what is this? And her response was, oh, it's nothing. It just happens sometimes. Ignore it. And I don't know if that was because she just didn't want to talk about it, or if she herself didn't know about the cycles and what happens. I know now, looking back, that it was probably my fertile mucus around the time I was ovulating. And that's something that when my daughter gets older, I want, when she hits puberty, to make sure she knows, like, how the cycle works and the other side effects of the cycle besides the menstruation. I think it's important. I had very strong, I still do have very strong pain. And I remember, like, all through high school, and there's no way to describe that to people because everyone expects you to have cramps on your period, not the other, you know, 2 weeks. That's part of how I want to educate my children is.
Can I give another suggestion for what could be involved in or included in sex education?
Yes, please.
One thing that I think might happen in some families or situations is that there is maybe an overemphasis on the fact that sex is good because it makes babies. I think something that should be included in sex ed is that sex can be good because it makes babies. Sex can be good because it allows two people who love each other to bond. Sex can be good because it feels good. I feel really strongly that all of those
purposes are great, honestly. And I worry sometimes that, well, for my own experience, that this idea that sex was good because it could make babies ended up being kind of a downer at a certain point, because with our sexual situation right now, I can't make a baby. My husband and I can't. And so then it kind of turns into this feeling of like, oh, so if I can't make a baby, am I, you know, we have these quotes about how when you make a baby, you're a joint creator with God, and that's why sex is good. So maybe should I not be having sex if I can't make a baby? Or is there something more to it? And I feel really strongly that there's something more to it, that it's about, you know, it has many purposes that can all be good. So I think that's something that I really want to include when I teach my own future kids about sex, is just the fact that the pleasure that comes from sex isn't just good because it can make another little human being, but because it's good for the human beings who are already here, you and your spouse. That's a perfectly wonderful use for it.
Sarah, pretty much everything that you're saying today, I just want to jump up and like say amen, sister, shouting hallelujah or something like that.
That makes me feel good.
But I completely agree with you. I think that I have read talks about sex that were given by general authorities, that it's not just for reproduction, but that it's also, you know, has the purpose of making the husband and wife feel closer to each other. But I agree that this is not very used in our culture. The part of reproducing and multiplying and replenishing the earth is kind of the focus. But every time I think about that, you know, I also remind myself that God made my clitoris, and that her only purpose is to give me pleasure and nothing else. And so if sex was only for reproducing, you know, there would be no need for a clitoris. So once I can teach my girls about that, I think that will help them understand that sex is for pleasure to be shared between two people, and that it's not just, you know, for making babies. And so, yeah, I just hope that the church would emphasize a little more that it's just to strengthen a bond between those two people, as well as, you know, creating a family.
There's one trend I've noticed that I think it's a good trend, but also it's kind of weird to me. I'm kind of conflicted over this, but I have heard people talk about, you know, that sex is good outside of making babies. And they say that, you know, they can be a spiritual experience. And that, I have no doubt it can be. A lot of times that is sometimes coupled along with the fear of, oh, we don't talk about it because it's sacred, and kind of like the temple. And I've heard the temple used to, you know, in the same conversation. And personally, I don't want to be thinking about the temple and having a temple-like spiritual experience while I'm having sex. But on the other hand, I think people are trying to, like, you know, it doesn't have to be just about children. It can bring you closer. But I think on sometimes it's not done well.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have run into that attitude.
No, I've heard it. And I think part of it is maybe, I think there's probably some good intention and some truth to it, that like, maybe the good intention is, well, if we talk about sex as being sacred, then that gives it a different connotation than talking about sex as being dirty or forbidden, which I think is great. I think what I really believe in is that sex is never just any one thing. If I teach, I'm definitely not going to teach my kids that sex is bad. But if I teach them that sex is good, maybe that's just as partially true as the idea that sex is bad. Like, sex isn't always going to be good. It's not always going to be spiritual. It's not always going to be fun. It's not always going to be scary. Like, it's going to be lots of things throughout their lives. And so I think an overemphasis on any area to the exclusion of the other feelings and the other purposes, it gives a skewed picture. And for like a certain subset, that skewed picture will be damaging.
I definitely agree. I've felt like one of the reasons that the church kind of basically says, we don't talk about sex, we don't talk about sex, don't let anybody look at you or touch you, or don't have, you know, sex is bad, bad, bad. When you're married, have babies. There's a really strong, we don't talk about sex type of a vibe. And I think that the big reason that they do that is because they they don't want anybody to have sex. Like, especially, you know, all of the people with their hormones flowing, i.e. young teens and teenagers and young adults, right? It doesn't seem like it would ever even cross their minds to actually say, okay, so do we want to address the reality of sex being part of the human experience? Because like you're saying, Sarah, if we try to relegate it only to the spiritual realm, we're skewing it. Mm-hmm. If we try to regulate it only to the physical realm, I think, again, we're skewing it. If we try to relegate it only to good experiences, we're definitely skewing it. Anyone ever heard of rape and abuse? Mm-hmm. If we're trying to relegate it only to it's a bad thing, we're skewing it. Like it's a human experience is what it is.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Me too. I agree.
I think that that's something that it could really benefit us all if it could be loosened up and spoken of as part of the human experience. Because then, like Julianne was saying, we have a clitoris that has as many nerve endings in it as a man's entire penis, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's awesome. And were any of us ever taught that we even had one? I certainly wasn't. As far as sex education went, it was to say that men are sexual and we're not. We're the gatekeepers. What if we were to be taught you are sexual because you're human? You're sexual because you're alive. You're sexual because that's part of the measure of your creation. I would like to see that brought in to the idea of sex education.
Amen, sister.
Okay, so what kinds of sex education have we been the instructors? Like, what kinds of sex education have we given?
I have had an experience with a friend, and I won't give any sort of identifiers at all because I want to respect her privacy. But I have an experience with a friend who got married, and when she did, she was frustrated to find that she didn't have an orgasm with sex right away. You know, she kind of thought that she would. She had always felt like a really sexual person, and I wanted to try to get across to her whatever knowledge I had, you know, as far as, listen, it takes some time. Like, this is a complex part of your body. It takes some time. It takes communication. And also the fact that I've seen cited worldwide, internet-wide, that most women do not orgasm from penile vaginal sex alone. You know, like something else has to be going on. And I tried to get this across to her, and because I remembered being in that same situation myself earlier in my life, like how eager she was for information, like any information I could give, any information any book or website could give, you know. And I kind of got the sense from my interaction with this particular friend and other friends who have gotten married or become sexual or whatever, that it's just like, oh, tell me what I need to know. I'm sick of not knowing this. I'm at a point in my life when I need to know this. And it's hard if you haven't practiced. It's hard to like really be specific about the words you use and to be straightforward instead of trying to like come up with an analogy. But I have felt really happy and empowered, and like I've done valuable service when I have talked to people and maybe helped in some way by providing insight about sex. I think that sex education can be a service, like an act of charity, because it is helping somebody to be happy in their marriage if they're married, or to be happy in some other way.
I, on the topic of, you know, what sex education we've done ourselves, for my own kids, my oldest is 3 years old, so what we do is use the correct term, and that's all we've done so far because that's all she's needed to know. But hopefully as she grows and asks us questions, we'll be open and good about that. There's one time where it wasn't that I was doing sex education, but I was kind of championing. I was at like a thing. It was mostly adults, but there's one 14-year-old girl, and someone mentioned pubic hair. And then suddenly there was like this hush, like, oh, you know, this girl, she, you know, and they're like, oh, we shouldn't be talking about this. She should know what that is. And I was like, she is 14 years old. She should know what pubic hair is, and we shouldn't be afraid to mention it in front of a 14-year-old girl. You know, it's not something that is totally off topic. I just felt like I wanted her to know that it's not wrong for her to know about these things, especially something that she should know by that point in time, you know. I kind of do like those sly kind of things that, you know, no, girls should know about these things. And she's 14 and it's very healthy for her to know about that.
And she probably has pubic hair.
Yeah.
It's not a secret.
I think most of the sex education that I have dished out, I suppose, would just be to my sisters and my friends. They'll call me with questions and things like that, or email me or whatever. And I think the reason that they contact me is because they know that I'm willing to talk about it, that I won't treat it like it's some kind of, that I won't treat it like it's dirty or weird. I will treat it frankly. And so they will call me and talk to me.
I haven't had much experience. Like I've said so far in this podcast, I'm very open with my own kids. My oldest is 5. She'll be 6 next month. And then they're turning 5 the end of the summer. And then we have a 3-year-old. So they're all still pretty young. But we do talk about our bodies and the correct terms, you know, like you, Heather. But they've also started asking questions about babies and where they come from and things like that. So we try to, well, I say we, but really it's me because my husband doesn't really talk to them about those things. But I try to give developmentally appropriate answers. You know, yeah. I don't want to shock them with something that they're not ready to digest or think about. So I'm very careful to only answer the questions that they're actually asking and not going into too much detail that they're either not interested in or that would confuse them. And I mm-hmm. think that's really important because I don't want to go overboard just because I'm very open and liberal kind of in my views. That doesn't mean that I want to overwhelm with information. So I'm trying to be, you know, careful with how much I am telling them. But I'm always, you know, open and they know that I will answer their questions if they ask me. I feel that one time that I guess I was kind of acting as a sex educator was with my husband. I didn't get a sex talk before we got married because, you know, I'd already had that talk with my mom like 2 days before then. And I'd already figured out pretty much everything I wanted to know. So my husband did get a sex talk, though, with his parents. And I asked him, so what'd they tell you? You know, before we got married, and he said, well, they told me not to do any kinky weird stuff. And so I'm like, oh man, that's too bad. So I'm not going to go into detail here because that's between my husband and I, but I feel like that it was very helpful that I knew about my body and that I knew what I liked and that I could tell him, and that made it a lot easier for us to explore sexuality with each other together. And I think that that's kind of a problem with a lot of couples in the church is that they are discouraged from exploring their sexuality. So they tend to not know very much about what they like or what, you know, arouses them or you know, how they like to be treated. And so I think that was really helpful that I already had a pretty good idea and that I could tell my husband and teach him and communicate those things.
I just had something come to mind that we don't talk about ever, but I think needs to be spoken about with women and men, is how sex changes as you move as in your life. You know, sex as, you know, maybe a newlywed in your early or mid-20s is going to be different than when you're in your 30s or 40s. And then if you have children and, you know, after giving birth, and so much changes. Even if you don't have children, sex is going to change. And I think that we don't talk about that kind of a thing and how expectations might change and other aspects of life, like having children affects, you know, the frequency of sex or the kind of sex you can have. You can't have long marathon sex when you have kids who are going to wake up any minute.
So, Julianne, I find it really interesting you describing being your husband's sex educator, because culturally, in the United States, that is traditionally what the man is supposed to be. He's supposed to be the one who knows everything, and the woman is supposed to know nothing.
Well, I don't think there are a lot of men who really know about even...
Oh, yeah. They don't.
Very much. So, you know, I thought of men who would like to meet their wife's needs better, but that it sometimes has something to do with the woman either not feeling that it's okay to really, really, really love sex and want to do it, or that they just don't know what exactly they like, or that they just feel uncomfortable exploring what they like because they feel like they can only have sex righteously. You know, I don't know whatever that means, but, you know, we were talking earlier about how sex is considered sacred in our church, and that is a good thing, but that can also be kind of a turnoff when you're either thinking that, you know, God is watching you while you're getting on, or that you think like you have to say an opening prayer before doing it, and then you have to sing a hymn afterwards to cleanse yourself of the filthy things you've just done. You know, there are ways in which the aspect of sanctity in that be a hindrance to really like getting stimulated, I think, because when we think about holy things, you know, definitely we think about, you know, church and the temple and the sacrament and the atonement and, you know, very kind of reverent, solemn, serious things. And for me, they don't necessarily fit together with sex, which doesn't mean that I haven't had any experiences that weren't both sexual and sacred. I have had those, but I've also had sexual experiences that were, you know, boring or that were funny, laugh out loud kind of funny.
Yeah.
Or that were very hot, passionate, really loud bed shaking experiences. And like we said before, you know, they're different depending on the situation, depending on the phase of family life that you're in, the day, the time of day or the mood that you're in, and all those things affect our sex lives.
Julianne, you brought up at the beginning when we were getting ready to start the podcast that a lot of LDS parents are really against sex education in school. And I remember when I was growing up, and I grew up in Utah, that we could have our parents sign a slip that said we didn't have to go to the sex education classes. And I was very shy and awkward and embarrassed and everything else. And I was terrified of sex because the church had told me that, you know, it was this second only to murder type of thing. Mm-hmm. That was the way that it had definitely come across to me. I was in no position to be marrying. I was 14 or whatever, you know. And so I always had my mom sign the slips so that I didn't have to go. But I do know that we were not taught about condoms or how to put one on, and that we were not taught about birth control. We were not taught about any of these types of things. Basically, what we were taught was the boy has the sperm and the girl has the egg, and when they get together, there's a baby. And women menstruate and men have wet dreams. And I think that was about the extent of it. I think one of the reasons that LDS parents are often against sex education in school is just for the same reason that the church is against sex education and instead promotes chastity and abstinence. It's just because they don't want to put it into the minds of anybody to go and do it. What else do you all think along those lines about kind of our opposition to being sexually educated as Mormons?
Well, I'll read again from the Gospel Principles Manual. It says, this is at the beginning, by the way, of the Law of Chastity lesson. It says, our church leaders have told us that parents are to teach their children about procreation, the process of conceiving and bearing children. And I think that that might be kind of where it's coming from, is just this personal belief that this is a conversation that needs to take place at home. When I was in college, I spent some time going to school in Portland, Oregon, and I took this amazing class called Sex and the Family. And it was rad in all ways. And one thing that our instructor really instilled in us was sex education, wherever it's coming from, whatever it contains, is about values. And it's about deciding what values are most important that you want to instill or that you want your children or your family members to subscribe to. Do you want your value to be about personal respect? Is your value pleasure? Is your value commitment and fidelity? Like, is your value knowledge? And I think for any parents who are leery about sex education in schools, probably part of it is that they feel like, I don't want my kids to get values about sex that come from somebody else, because maybe they're not the values that I want my kid to have. Maybe that's why some parents wouldn't want their kids to learn about condoms, because they feel like that's not a part of my value structure. But I feel like, you know, if it's really important to you that your kids learn about sex at home rather than at school or at church or from their friends, then you dang well better be teaching them. You know, don't just kind of use that as like a cop-out phrase, oh, I'll teach them that at home. Like, they really need to be taught at home. And that's the problem, is that sometimes they're not.
That's exactly what my issue was with that, is that, you know, the friends that I've talked to or people in the church that are very strongly against sex education in schools are the very same people who will not even tell their kids the correct terms for their own genitalia.
Right.
So I'm thinking, well, I hope your kids get some sex ed in school, because they're certainly not getting it from you, and they have to get some information from somewhere. So I'm totally for parents doing it themselves, you know, teaching their kids the way that they want sex to be taught. I think that's preferable over any other method. But I think that, you know, we need to start really early with that, because at least my kids, you know, they're already asking in their like preschool and kindergarten age. And so if we wait until they're teenagers, then we're going to have missed the boat. They've already, I mean, we've all been teenagers. We know that, you know, you will pick up stuff from your friends or from books, you know, anything like that. So that's why I start early with my kids, but I will be totally fine if they have sex ed in school. And I think part of where my opinions come from is that I just grew up in a different culture where I think we had sex ed in fifth or sixth grade, and it was just part of our biology class that we had to take. It was mandatory. And so we had some discussion about sex education, and it, you know, it was very basic and very boring. And our teacher told us if we laughed, we'd get sent out of the classroom. So there wasn't really anything crazy about it. And there was no religious connotation to it. And I feel that here in America, not only in the LDS culture, but, you know, conservative America in general kind of feels so heavily related to religion and morals because they're afraid that their kids will be taught about, you know, contraceptions when they just don't want their kids to have sex, or they will be taught about STDs and how to protect themselves from those when their parents just don't want them to have sex at all. Or they'll be taught about homosexuality or abortion or, you know, things like that, that go into this, you know, gray area of moral religious associations that I feel like really the reason why people don't want their kids to hear that in school, rather than anatomy and biological functions and how we actually make babies and things like that.
It seems like the attitude is, if we don't teach them about sex and contraceptives and whatever else, then they won't have sex. And that's not true.
No, it's not.
Many of them will be explorative sexually.
Yeah. And can I just say that, you know, statistically, in countries such as Germany, where I'm from, where, you know, sex ed is like mandatory in schools and, you know, things like that are discussed more openly, the age of when teenagers first have sex is actually higher, and the rate of teenage pregnancies is lower than in the United States. And I find that really telling, because, you know, I get a lot of flack from people here saying, well, Germany and other European countries, they're pretty much nudist colony, your nudist beaches and all your nude artwork and sculptures and all your talk about contraception and, you know, sex education in schools and la-di-da-di-da and, you know, stuff like that, where when you look at how it actually plays out in reality, the results that we're getting in Europe are the results that people here desire from not talking about those things or not making those things available. I don't understand why people don't see the disconnect between the theory and practice.
I would like to add a little bit to that. I think that sex education also empowers children and teens and stuff against things that, like, sexual assault. It might not prevent sexual assault, but it will help them speak out against it. I remember reading families who do use the anatomically correct terms, there's less sexual molestation and stuff in those families. And if a girl was raped or assaulted at school or party or whatever, she has the words then and doesn't feel the shame around talking about her body and saying, you know what, that person touched me in a way that I was not comfortable. And I think that if we don't talk about sex openly, then there's this, like, oh, something happened, and what if I'm guilty of something bad and I shouldn't tell anyone? And yeah. I think that being open about these things is actually a protective measure for children.
I agree completely.
Me too. Such an important point you brought up, Heather.
And I think, too, maybe part of all this, or maybe the overarching thing, is that we just don't like thinking about our kids as sexual beings. We, of course, as parents, of course, we don't want to face the concept that our children could be abused or assaulted. And we don't want to think about them having sex ever. You know, we don't want to think about them masturbating or anything. And maybe it's not even, maybe the whole idea that we're not teaching them about sex so they won't have sex is just a cover for the fact that we don't even want to face sex and our kids being in the same sentence. We just are like, no, that's not going to work. And that probably goes back to ideas about sex being bad or being dirty. I think it's all related.
When I was engaged to my husband, he and I went home so he could meet my parents. I also was going to go to the gynecologist to get on birth control for, you know, when we got married. We were just talking about what we're going to do the next day or whatever. And on that list of things to do the next day was for me to go to my appointment. And I mentioned that out loud, and my 16-year-old sister was there. And my dad was really, really upset that I mentioned birth control and in front of my 16-year-old sister. And in the car on the way to the gynecologist, my mom told me about that. And I was really shocked that he was upset about that. And she's like, you should talk to him. So I went and I talked to him, and I told him that I really felt that him not wanting me to talk about birth control made me feel like he didn't want me to enjoy sex and be a full adult person and enjoy things. And he felt, when we had this conversation, he told me that he just didn't want my 16-year-old sister hearing about sex, and surely I should birth control, and surely I should understand that. Unfortunately, that story didn't end completely well, because she did become pregnant a couple years later. Was she a teen still when that happened? I think she was. And she's got a son now, and she's a single mom. And I don't know if that's directly related to the fact that my parents never talked about birth control, but I think the inability to talk about sex in our family may have contributed a little bit to the outcomes there. But anyway, when you were talking about how, you know, we don't want our children to be sexual and stuff, that reminded me of those feelings I had when my dad didn't want me to mention birth control. I felt like, I was going to be married, and I felt like he didn't want me to be a person and enjoy what being a human is about.
What in the Mormon church trips us up about sex, and what about the Mormon church gives us a leg up about sex?
I have some answers for the second part of that question, at least. One of the things is this thing that Amelia talked about in our Feminine Divine podcast about the idea that we have bodied gods, that our Heavenly Mother and Father have bodies, and that our bodies are necessary, and that they are good and a gift, and that the ability to keep these bodies is a huge blessing of being exalted beings one day. I think the fact that we have a respect for our bodies could really lend itself in the church to feeling like, okay, then let's celebrate these bodies. Let's celebrate what they can do. Let's be happy for every part of them. I think it's an opportunity that we should really explore. Another thing that I think is a great asset in Mormonism is our emphasis on agency. And I think a respect for another person's agency and a respect for our own agency really plays a huge part in figuring out sex as you get older, figuring out that you need to respect somebody else's boundaries and you need to use your own agency to make right choices. I think one thing that frustrates me in general as a feminist is victim blaming when it comes to sexual assault and things of this nature, you know, as though women could somehow keep themselves from being raped, as opposed to men keeping themselves from being rapists. And I think that that's a real opportunity in the church to say, maybe especially to young men, but to young women as well, no matter what, you do not violate someone else's agency. That's important to know in a marriage. That's important to know in your dating relationships. And the third thing that I think is a real asset is that we, at least theologically, we have an equality in our sexual expectations between men and women. Men and women both need to keep the law of chastity, and they are both responsible for doing that. And I think that that's a real advantage, as opposed to maybe some other cultures or traditions where in reality, women are supposed to be virgins and men are supposed to just get their jollies wherever because they're men. I know that that cultural expectation does sort of come into Mormonism, as far as we were talking about earlier, with women being guardians of virtue and men, you know, this discourse about men being sex crazed or something. But at least theologically, we do have an equality when it comes to what we expect and what sex is supposed to be for men and for women. So I think those are things that are great positives, and that we should really take advantage of those.
You know, the only thing that really bothers me about how sex is addressed in the church is that it's not really addressed. And I mean, that pretty much sums it up. Since joining the church, I've always felt discouraged from talking about sex to anybody, told by local leaders that it's something that's only to be discussed you know, between my husband and I, if at all. You know, it doesn't really seem like open discourse about sex is encouraged. And partly I understand that because we feel that it's sacred and that it is very special and that it's a very private matter. And I can understand that a lot of people aren't comfortable talking about it. But I personally feel that there's a great need to exchange information and experiences and questions in, you know, a safe place, you know, in a circle of friends with similar beliefs and values. And I just don't think that that's encouraged within the church. I feel that the way are taught about sex is detrimental sometimes, especially the young women. If we remember those horrible, you know, object lessons about chastity, you know, like the licked cupcake and the chewed up gum and things like that, that are supposed to tell young girls or what they're going to be like if they let a boy violate them in that way. I mean, there's just so much baggage with the way we talk about sex in the church that I think the only way to help that is if there is an allowance of people actually talking about it, if there's a permission that people actually get to openly talk about it, if there would be either like society lessons about that or parents would be more encouraged to talk to their children openly, you know, like that. I don't know how else to say it other than the thing that trips me up most about sex education in the church is that it's not open enough for me. I feel like there's not enough discussion, there's not enough conversation, and there's definitely a lot of taboo topics that are never, hardly ever discussed, like rape and abuse and things like that. Another thing that really bothers me is that if a guy watches porn once, he's considered a porn addict. I think that's completely ridiculous BS. That's not true. From a medical standpoint, you know, that's not at all what an addiction is. I've been a facilitator in the church's addiction recovery program for a few years until recently. And the thing that drives me crazy in that program is that if you have one drink, you're considered an alcoholic. If you watch porn once, you're a porn addict. You know, if you masturbate occasionally, you're you know, your bishop might send you to that meeting. And I just think that we create a bigger problem with that. We create a cycle of shame. You know, mm-hmm. If just any other guy out there in the world goes and watches porn, you know, he probably eventually will turn it off, make himself a sandwich, and then go do something else, you know. But in the church, if a guy watches porn, he'll immediately feel guilt. If he goes and confesses to him, there will be a huge, huge deal about that. And it will start this cycle of obsessing about it all the time, which is going to make him much more likely to do it again and again and again and actually get into an addiction.
Yeah.
So I don't like the way we throw around the word addiction in the church in general, and especially when it comes to sex addictions or pornography and the way we talk about masturbation. I think it's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I think it's interesting, Julianne, because some of the ways that I think that the church trips us up about sex is because it always talks about it. Not always. There's an exception. In order to get pregnant and have a baby, that is encouraged. But aside from that, all of the other ways that the church pretty much talks about sex is to say, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. Like back in the 80s, I can't come up with a date right here. If anybody can, let me know. It was even a question on the Temple Recommend interview about oral sex. And if you were participating in oral sex with your spouse, you were denied a Temple Recommend. And in my opinion, the church ought to get the hell out of the bedroom. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's like porn is bad, masturbation's bad, oral sex is bad, petting's bad, necking's bad, 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 bad. It's like they're trying to tell us all the ways that we can sin instead of telling us all the ways that we can rejoice in being sexual beings, because we are sexual beings. We're going to be sexual beings just simply because that's the nature of being a human creature. And so there's no rejoicing in that. Instead, there is only shame, like you were saying, Julianne, a tremendous amount of shame and a tremendous amount of focus that the purpose of sex is to procreate and to draw husband and wife closer together. But we're not going to talk about that. Do you know what I mean?
I agree with, I don't feel quite as strongly. I think it's fine for the church to to counsel against certain things. I mean, I'm not trying to make a case for pornography. I think in general, you know, it's an industry that, you know, exploits and denigrates women and everybody who participates in it. And so I'm not trying to say that, you know, watching porn is wholesome or anything like that. But I would like to see the church not make such a huge deal out of it in the way that they're going to make it worse and actually kind of push people toward doing it more. You know, the same with masturbation. You know, I think it's normal for anybody to explore their bodies and their sexual feelings. I'm not going to teach my kids that it's wrong to do that. I'm going to teach them that, you know, they need to do it in private and that we don't like touch ourselves in public and, you know, common sense things like that. The thing that bothers me is that the discourse about sex in the church is very black and white, when for me, it's a huge gray area. I agree with you. I think they shouldn't ever tell us which practices are righteous and appropriate and which aren't. It's none of their business what we do with each other in our bedroom or anywhere else in our house where we want to. And with the oral sex, I didn't actually know that that was a question on the Temple Recommend interview. I heard that that was a letter sent from the First Presidency to local church leaders. It wasn't one of those open letters that's read in sacrament meeting. It was just going to church leaders and saying that they needed to discourage members from the practice of oral sex. And I guess they got so much flack from bishops and other church leaders that they had to retract the letter. And you can't actually find the original letter on the internet. And the copies that are circulating, nobody knows if they've been tampered with or not. But obviously, there's enough people who still remember, you know, that that used to be an issue in the church. And so I think stuff like that, I'm totally with you, is completely ridiculous. And I would never let anybody tell me whether or not I can have oral sex with my husband.
And I think something you said earlier, Julianne, I felt like was really relevant to this particular conversation about oral sex. You're saying, you know, just that there's not enough openness about this topic in the church. And I think because we're unwilling to talk, some of these older ideas, even I think this was from the 80s, this particular oral sex debacle, I think that these ideas get perpetuated. I was not even alive when this came out, but I have heard multiple times from people that oral sex was, I don't know, an abomination, that it was inappropriate in, you know, all of that. Before we got married, my husband told me that his brothers and other people he had known who had gotten married, when they would go in for their Temple Recommend interviews with their bishops would tell them pointedly that they could do anything except have anal sex or do role playing in their sex lives. And so and my husband was just relating this to me kind of to be like, hey, so expect that this might come up when we go and get, you know, for our own interview. We went to two separate interviews because we were in different wards, but we both went to both of them. And the message that I really appreciated from both of our bishops was, you can do anything that you want sexually in your marriage as long as you both feel okay about it. And I was like, that's so much more refreshing. And that's a wonderful thing. It kind of bothers me that there's this need to feel like we've gotten permission to do something. But if we're going to get permission, I'd like permission to do whatever I want, I guess. But because it's not an outright statement or an outright message that's sent throughout the church, like the older ideas still get perpetuated, and you still hear that you shouldn't have oral sex, and you still hear that other things are off limits depending on, you know, what other people have heard in their own day. And I find that very frustrating. I really do think that it's over the line.
Yeah. And how sad that generations of people have missed out on sexual practices that actually could have brought them a lot of pleasure and brought them closer to each other, just because some church leaders thought that it was their place to step over that line and tell them what they could or could not do in their bedroom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it gives this feeling that, like, you need to be nervous that you're still going to do something wrong. Like, even after you've gotten married in the temple, maybe, and you're, like, with your spouse, you're, like, still on guard for the ways that you could sin.
Yeah.
And it's just, so much stress. There's so much stress.
So as we're wrapping up, Sarah has a project that she'd like to present to us. So go ahead, Sarah.
Well, just from my own experiences, I feel really strongly about the need to create a healthier approach to sex for our young people. And I think the biggest component to that is parenting, at least in an ideal situation. So I'm actually working on a project with my best friend in order to create a resource that is especially for Mormon parent, pretty faithful, really honest, scientifically sound, that's just supposed to be a help for handling all aspects of sex education, whether that's maturation and puberty or actual sex or safe sex or homosexuality or abuse. Like, we want to really make it as comprehensive and helpful for everybody as we can. What we have in mind right now is a book with an accompanying website, and we're in the early stages, and we're trying to get stories from people. We're trying to get a sense of what people's needs are in the larger Mormon community. And if you're listening and you would like to share your own story, or you know somebody who might, we would love for you to send it into us. We're interested in how you've handled sex education as a parent, or how your parents handled it with you, or just suggestions, cautions, observations of any kind, no limits. You can contact us by sending an email to mormonsexedproject@gmail.com. You know, my friend and I, we're just two people with a narrow set of experiences. So other people's input is really precious to us. And we promise that we'll respect your privacy. And we would just love to hear from you, whatever it is you want to say.
That sounds like such an excellent project, Sarah. I'm so glad that you and your friend are doing that.
We're really excited. And I think it's judging from just our own experiences of how much people hunger for information about this in our community, I hope it will be as helpful as we think it will be.
Excellent. And we'll put that email address on the links list for this podcast in case you have forgotten what it is and want to send some information into Sarah. Thanks, ladies, for talking through sex education here. This was good. Thanks for listening to Daughters of Mormonism. I invite you to respond at daughtersofmormonism.blogspot.com.
Special thanks to Sarah for editing this episode, and thanks to Kevin McLeod for the music.